Welcome back to Dan Has a Plan Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm Daniel B. Smith, a certified financial planner on the Family and Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
We're back.
We're located in Paramus, New Jersey, and I can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. Our guest today is Bruce Haberle. Bruce is the head wrestling coach at NYU, New York University.
How did we swing this one?
Gotta know people.
You really do. This is a celebrity. Because we've already talked about this one on the podcast.
So those of you who remember one of our previous episodes, Michael Worthington, a neighbor of ours, is an avid wrestler. And Bruce, being a wrestling coach and living in the same town, our paths crossed. Obviously, yep. But we have to circle back to baseball, which is really how we cross paths. So I had the good fortune of coaching Bruce's son, Roman.
Right. Yes.
Another baseball reference. I'm sure the audience has had their fill.
I don't think they have. I think it's your signature. It's your stamp. Okay, so you were Roman's coach?
I was. And I had a great deal of fun coaching him. Obviously, I got to know Bruce and his lovely wife, Michelle. I also had the good fortune of, on occasion, coaching Roman's brother, Trevor. Got to give a shout out to Trev.
Yeah, shout out to the whole Haberle team.
Yes, yes.
So what are your favorite things about Bruce?
H-U-M-O-R.
Sense of humor?
He has the most tremendous sense of humor of maybe anyone I've ever met.
That's awesome.
Yes. He makes everything fun.
All right. So before we get talking to Bruce, we have a question.
Oh, boy.
All right. So this listener writes in, and I thought it would be, it's perfect for our guest today. She says, "Hi, Dan. I'm a mom of a Division III volleyball player at Muhlenberg. My daughter's majoring in psychology, and playing on the team has been such a lifeline for her. It's given her confidence, community, and joy. But there's no scholarship money, and the costs are real. Tuition, travel, equipment, it all adds up. She's talking about taking out loans and picking up a part-time job just to stay afloat. We both know she's not going pro. This sport isn't her future, but it's such a big part of her right now. I just want to do right by her to support what she loves without setting her up for financial stress after graduation. How do parents like me walk that line between being present for the moment and protecting their financial future?"
Wow.
It's a great question.
That is a great question.
It's a concerned mom question.
It is. How I would attack this question if I were sitting face to face with this woman, I think you have to start with hopes and dreams. I'm a big believer, and this is kind of counterintuitive to traditional financial planning advice. You want to make sure that your child is pursuing something that brings them joy. And certainly volleyball seems to be the center of this question. And it brings her camaraderie. It brings her a sense of community. It brings her self-satisfaction. The difference between a Division I and a Division III athlete is rather cavernous. There is no future of making a living being a volleyball player, by and large. I'm sure there's exceptions.
Yeah, but I think people going into D3 know that, right?
They do. And, I know Muhlenberg is a private college. I know approximately what the costs are. And what I would say is just having a heart-to-heart with your daughter. And I've been involved in many of these conversations where you just have to lay out the dollars and cents versus quashing a dream.
And also she's asking about should her daughter take on loans and or a part-time job? I know you were a D3 athlete.
I was.
And you had part-time jobs.
Yeah, I worked in the summer. I worked during the school year. I also had loans when I came out of college. What you have to do, and this wasn't, my circumstance because none of those things were discussed, but I want to answer this question of this woman. The counterbalance that is if you take out loans, obviously it's going to meet the financial obligation to pay the school. If you counterbalance that with working on campus, it subsidizes what you would have to take out in loans. But the post-college experience might be something like, instead of getting a job and moving out and getting your own apartment, et cetera, might be living at home for a couple of years. Are you willing to pay that price? Okay. So that's where, really the transition of financial planning goes from the parent to the daughter. That's really when she should start doing her financial plan. So there's definitely a path to getting this type of equation done, but it really comes down to meeting with someone that can guide them through this emotional decision.
Right. And having open and honest conversations about it all. I think what I'm hearing in the question is just a lot of worry and fear. And I think what you're saying is the plan, as usual, takes care of the worry and fear.
Yeah. And I think my sense is that these open discussions aren't being had with the daughter. And that can turn into a real and emotional experience. So meeting with a planner to discuss the parameters of that decision. So both the mom and the daughter are fully aware going in, eyes wide open. And then post-college, the daughter transitioning to her financial plan and whatever the indebtedness is to attack that first before getting on the path of saving and, you know, securing her financial future.
Right. So I think what we're saying is don't quit volleyball. We can figure it out.
Yeah. I would never advise, you know, not pursuing a passion.
Yeah.
As long as it's a healthy passion.
All right. Well, talking about healthy passions, I think we got to get Bruce on here to weigh in his 2 cents on D3 athletics and hear some tales from the mat.
The Bruce Haberle. Jackson Hole, good place.
Oh, man, is it.
Nice pancakes there.
Yeah. You've had them, right?
I've had them. I took Ben there for banana pancakes.
Very nice.
You took me there.
Yes, I took a lot.
Did you get the blueberry?
I did not.
They put fresh blueberries in those pancakes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I know.
I haven't been there in ages, but.
We're joined today by the coach of NYU Wrestling, Bruce Haberle. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you.
We're so lucky to have you on this podcast. It's very fancy.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Head coach?
I'm feeling pretty good right now.
Okay. Yeah. We talk about coaching a lot on this podcast.
Yes. I'm not surprised.
So before you became a head coach at NYU, walk us down the path. What was your history with wrestling? When did you start? Where did you wrestle? You know, give us a little Reader's Digest version here.
Okay. This is a good question. I like this question.
Yeah.
So I guess in seventh grade, probably as far back as fifth grade, I played basketball. That's where a lot of wrestlers started, in basketball.
Okay.
And so I got to, let's say, seventh grade, and then they had middle school tryouts. And I thought clearly I was the best kid on the team. And I got cut first. I was the first one cut.
Oh, stinger.
So obviously my judgment was off. And I had this, like, a great defensive move that nobody else had, like cover the eyes without fouling them.
Oh,
you know, things like
cover
that.
Cover the eyes.
Covered, yeah.
Tremendous.
So I tried these things. The coach did not like it. Cut me right off the bat. And I said, okay, I'll wrestle as a seventh grader. And I was terrible, but I wrestled as a seventh grader. The story continues. Eighth grade, I went back out for basketball, got cut first again. And still, in my mind, I was better than everybody else in the grade.
This is feeling personal.
It was rough. And so I went out for wrestling. And at that point, I stuck with wrestling. So I was so bad. I was so bad at wrestling. I wrestled in seventh grade. I wrestled eighth grade. I won my first match in ninth grade.
Wow. That's dedication.
So you lost every match in seventh and eighth grade?
Correct.
Oh, my God.
Correct. I didn't know we were going to get an underdog story today. I'm very excited.
Oh, yeah.
This is tremendous.
Wow.
What was it that made you stay with it? Usually defeat is like, you know, the exit stage left.
So there's a few things. One, a lot of things that happened in my life was a result of where things were with my dad. So my dad was kind of proud of the physical contact sport.
Okay.
He boxed in the Navy. He liked the one-on-one thing. So he was kind of proud, and making my dad proud was huge. So I continued to wrestle, and you know wrestling is a fight.
Yeah.
I got my butt whooped so much that I wasn't afraid. So that was kind of a thing that I've come to realize why I stuck with it. I go out there and I get just crushed and I would walk off the mat. All right, I survived. And then so one day I won a match. And once I won a match, something was clicking in my head saying, maybe I don't have to stink. You know? So that's how it all began.
Was there a coach that you connected with early in your wrestling career?
I also love that question. My high school coach was the best. And when I say the best, he wasn't the best technician, but he was a guy that you loved. Right. And I think a lot of time that's what happens. My high school coach was just so much fun. He would sing "Don't Let Me Down" by the Beatles while we're wrestling. And just like publicly, you know, I can remember a kid named Mike Kahn, who was clearly the worst kid on the high school team. And Mike Kahn won a match. He did a big picture of King Kong, but he changed it to King Kong. You know? So he did things that were very memorable. He was enjoyable. That experience through high school is what carried me over. And I wasn't the greatest high school wrestler. I was one of those guys who kept getting better at a slow pace, right? Mm. So by the time I was a senior, I was honorable mention, all county.
There were six kids in your family. Where were you?
Second to youngest.
Second youngest?
Yep, yep.
I got
a little brother who moved upstate New York. My family bought a campground right on the Delaware River. So after high school, I went up there. I helped them run it before I went to college in that year. And by the way, there's no wrestling up there at the time.
Yeah.
I kept working out. I put a mat on the second floor of a barn. I had weights and I was doing all that stuff. And at the end of a year, you know, I had to confront my dad and say, Dad, I'm not saying. I got to go back here.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And he was upset. He was so upset. But I mean, I wanted to live my life and he had plans for me. He wanted me to live the life he wanted me to live. He wanted me to stay by his side, mm-hmm. run the campground, stay there.
Gotcha.
It was done in my mind. Yeah. I didn't know where I was going to college, but I was going to find a way. So different time, right? So, you know, when I say different time, I wasn't going to go to college. My parents were going to pay for it.
Right.
I was going to find my own way. And I knew that. I didn't have to discuss it with anybody. I just knew it. So I came home, I worked, and then I started applying. I would go to the New York Athletic Club to work out on Tuesdays and Thursday nights, which is in the city. I would take a bus, public transportation into the city, and you go in there. Like I said, after all those beatings, I wasn't afraid of anything. So you go into the New York AC room, you got Division I national champs, you got Olympians, you got all these people.
So it's a wrestling gym specifically.
The New York AC is a private club in the city.
Okay.
Right? Where they fund clubs of all sports, all Olympic sports.
Oh, wow.
With the exception of things like football. You know, baseball, Olympic sports that are non-revenue sports, track, although it's tough to say track's a non-revenue sport these days, but, you know, fencing, track, wrestling, boxing.
How did you know about it?
There was a guy on my team, Dave Weck, his brother Dan Weck, would go to the New York Athletic Club. And so he would say he's taking Dave, his brother. So I eventually hooked on with them, and then they wouldn't go all the time. And when they didn't go all the time, I kept going.
Nice.
Oh, this is like a movie in the making. So you're at the gym.
Yeah.
And what happens next?
So it's actually, there is something there. So I'm working out at the New York Athletic Club. And then there's a guy that I'm friendly with even today. I've known him forever. His name is Paul Lapano. He was the assistant coach at Hunter College. Oh. And so he started seeing me. We got to know each other's name. And then he eventually said, where are you going next year? I said, somewhere. I don't know where, but somewhere. And he said, well, why don't you come to Hunter? That's all he had to say.
Nice.
It wasn't like, what majors do you have?
Right. You just
none
needed
of that mattered.
Someone.
Yeah. Yep. He said, do you want to come to Hunter? I said, yes. I just needed somebody to want me to come.
Yeah.
You know, so he said, you know, when you want to come visit? He goes, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, nothing. And then I went over and met the coach, the head coach at Hunter. And
nice.
The whole thing said, can you get me in?
Wow.
And that was it. It was one shot.
Tremendous.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yep.
So Hunter College is where?
68th and Lexington Avenue, New York City. Four buildings on four corners, north, south, east, west, on four corners.
So this is a Division III school?
Yes, correct.
Take us from there.
I went to Hunter College. I was just a different wrestler. This is probably where I made my biggest jump right from the start because I was excited. So I was going to tournaments and everything prior and doing everything that a good wrestler should do. Realistically, as my father would say, I was majoring in wrestling. That could be criticized, right? But on the flip side, it was a means to a degree.
Sure was.
And I was much better. By the time I got to college, I was hard to beat.
So wow.
I was winning tournaments and getting OWs and all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
OWs is MVP.
Yeah, this is good.
So yeah.
What a story. I love this story. So you wrestle at Hunter, you graduate from Hunter. What's on tap for Bruce?
I'm going to coach in college. It's already in my head.
Nice.
So, right. Just keep going.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So I stayed in the city and I lived with a buddy of mine, Raphael, who was an All-American for LSU and Brockport, and he used to come in the room and coach. So I moved in with him and I got my eyes and ears open. And LIU Post opened up a position for the head coach.
Okay.
I was not getting that job. So I'm like, Raphael, I got a job for you. You know, he's already working. He's like a bartender. I said, you're a bartender. Your 4 o'clock is free. You know, you're coaching. He said, what are you talking about? LIU Post. We got to get you over there for the interview for the job. And he said, why? I said, because I'm the assistant coach.
Right, so, right. Take me with you.
It happened exactly that way. He applied for the job. The administration didn't even interview me. Raphael just said, yeah, you're my assistant. I think I got paid like $2,000. All right, I'm getting something. I would have done it for nothing.
Right.
So I was assistant for him for 1 year. And he, Raphael, lovely guy, great guy, terrible coach. Good technician, but terrible coach. He was probably the funniest coach you'd ever want to meet, but just terrible. So as we're wrestling meets, we're wrestling Manhattan College. And I'm watching the bench at Manhattan College, and the kids are just very disrespectful to the head coach. You could tell the head coach, they didn't care much either. You could just tell. So, and then the kids are laughing at him and whatnot. And I said, okay, this guy's not going to be here beyond this year.
Yeah, you're seeing it all unfold.
Yeah, Yep. And then the job opened up and I was at the doorstep.
Wow.
So, yeah. This is amazing.
I went on to Manhattan College.
Tremendous.
The guy who hired me at Manhattan College is a well-known basketball guy, Jack Powers. He was the vice president of the NIT. He was the greatest guy. And he was so honest with me. You know, like when I said, listen, this guy's got 8 scholarships. This guy's got 2 scholarships. This guy's got 3. Can I have 1? He go, Bruce, he was very upfront.
Right.
He never lied to me. He was just like, it's not in the cards.
So you were a Jasper.
I was a Jasper, yes.
Just tell the audience what a Jasper is.
It's a Christian brother. His last name was Jasper, who invented the 7th inning stretch.
See, another baseball reference.
Right, yes. It all comes back.
Oh, my God.
He invented 7th inning stretch. So it was a scrimmage between Manhattan College and I think maybe West Point, but not positive.
Okay.
And it was a boring game. So as we got it to the 7th inning, he stopped the game and said, everybody stand on your feet. This take 5 minutes, this stretch, and then continue the game.
So it was a stretch.
So it was a 7th inning stretch, and that's what it was about. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's where it came from.
Gotta shake it up.
I didn't see this coming.
Yeah, yep. This is great.
I got some information.
You certainly do. Love it. Love it. So you're living your dream.
Yeah, I had the job at Manhattan College for 7 years, and then they dropped it. So
they dropped wrestling as a sport.
They dropped wrestling, yes.
Okay.
Sad.
And that was heartbreaking. Yeah. That was because in my mind, that was my first real job. I was like, what other job is there in this world? This is the only job there is, you know?
Yeah. Right.
That's where my mind and my heart was. And I was heartbroken, right? So here I am. I'm fighting for my program. And the president of the university, for some reason, I don't think he liked me very much. I don't know why. I didn't do anything wrong. But neither here nor there. It was one of those colleges where they have tiers, right? So these programs are our top tier. And it's going to be basketball and track, full allotment of scholarships, the whole thing. Then you got tier 2, and then you got tier 3, and you got tier 4. We were probably tier 4.
So at the time you were there, Manhattan was a what? Division 1?
It was Division 1.
It was?
Yeah.
Okay. And, and you couldn't get 1 scholarship for a Division 1 athlete.
I ended up getting a half.
Half
a scholarship.
Oh, my God. Wow.
I gave it to a New Jersey boy named Stephen Harrison, who was a state runner-up from Camden Catholic.
So we talk a lot about work ethic. I mean, it comes up a lot in financial planning, staying the course and trusting the plan and looking at the bigger picture. Obviously, you have an amazing work ethic. It got you to where you are. What do you see in college students that makes you say you got to stick with this? How does that come into play in what you do?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that are said in my sport that kind of carries over into education, carries over into academics. One of the things that Dan Gable said, and you've heard of Dan Gable.
I've heard of Dan Gable.
Dan Gable said, once you've wrestled, everything else in life is easy, you know? So, you know, I don't know how true that is, but I think there is a certain amount of truth to it. I think it teaches you discipline, teaches you time management. It's obviously terrific on a resume. There's companies out there who look for wrestlers. Yeah.
This is a pro tip.
There are companies out there who look to almost hire exclusively wrestlers.
That's a fact.
Yeah. Really? Wait, tell me more.
Yeah. The analogy I would make is, as Bruce said, wrestling is so difficult. I'll just go back to high school. When I was in high school, I played basketball, but I used to help a classmate of mine try to get down to weight. So I would go into the wrestling room at lunch hour with him. And my job was to try to move him. And we did it for 2 minutes at a time, because that's what the timing was in a wrestling match at the time.
The length of a period. Yeah.
Yeah. After 2 minutes and not even being able to budge this kid, I collapsed on the ground, gasping for air, gasping. I've never, ever done anything more physically taxing in my life.
I have never heard this story, so this is great.
Tim Heyer, he went on to play in the USFL. He was a middle linebacker for the Jacksonville Bulls. That's the guy. He would play football at 230 pounds and wrestle at 165 in the winter.
Not good. They made rules to fix that.
Yeah, that's not a good thing to do for anybody.
No.
But this guy, it was a different time.
This guy was so country strong.
Yeah.
Bruce, I couldn't move the guy.
Strong base. Yeah.
I weighed more than him, but there was no way.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the analogy I always give is wrestlers and engineers. Okay. Yep. You can go to school to be an engineer and you can throw that resume on any CFO's desk of any public company in the United States. If you wrestled or you're an engineer, you got a little leg up. Definitely.
There is a tool company out there that's a well-known company, right? You would know the company in a heartbeat that shows up to the wrestling events everywhere because they only hire wrestlers. And they show up to the Beast of the East in Delaware. They show up to the big events.
The mindset of a wrestler, just from a hiring perspective, is singular focused, organized, great work ethic, time management skills, not willing to give up and putting the work in. And it's greatly needed in this country, trust me.
Did you find that the criticism along the way was fuel or was it hard?
No, criticism was fuel more than hard. I mean, I knew if I let something bring me down, it's going to hurt more than just me. It's going to hurt everything that goes along with the program. So you can't let anything bring you down. If you want to have success, you can't use those excuses, right? You got to find a way to get things done. Like hardships, you look at the COVID year. I had probably one of the best wrestlers I've ever coached during that window of time.
Wow.
As a junior, he's in Stern School of Business. And in 4 years, in one summer session, he has two bachelors and a master's out of Stern.
Wow.
You wouldn't know he had schoolwork. He will not put anything on you. Obviously, very well brought up, right? One of the best kids. He's very humble, kind of quiet. And the kid his junior year is ranked sixth in the country. So as we get to the end of the season, he calls me the night before we leave for the NCAA qualifier, where he's seated number one. He said, "Coach, I'm in the emergency room." He goes, "I have to have emergency surgery." Wow. And he had surgery. He's in practice the next day, just sitting down on the side, quiet. He's kind of teary-eyed. I don't know what to do. All I could do is say, "Sean, are you okay, buddy? What can I do for you?" And he was like, "I'm fine." He just wanted to be left alone. He goes, "I'm a captain. I feel like I should be here." His season was over.
Oh.
Senior year, right, he loses one match to a Division II national champ early in the season in a close bout. And then he goes on a tear where he texts or pins everybody the rest of the year.
Wow.
Now he's ranked number two in the country, where, you know, I think he's ranked number one. Now he's not a cocky guy. He's very humble. We're on our way to the national championships. And he comes over and he kind of whispers to me and he said, "Coach," he goes, "you know nobody can beat me, right?" I love this kid, right? And I'm like, "Sean, you and I both know that, but keep it to ourselves and you just do your thing." We get out to the national championships, go through registration. We have 4 out of 10 guys at the national championships.
Wow.
Right? We go through the registration a whole bit. Everybody checks their weight. Everything is perfect. We go to a supermarket. Guys are buying their food for after weigh-ins. And I get a call from the NCAA. Tournament's canceled. Now, the first COVID is starting to come out.
Oh, God.
This was like March 2020?
Yeah, I guess that's when it was, yes. So,
you blocked it out.
You look at 2 years of the most expected things that can happen to one person.
Yeah.
And so now you got 4 guys standing in the aisle. I go in, I got to tell these guys. So I go up to them and I say, "Guys, come here." I call them over. I just put it out there. It's canceled. You know, I said, "I know how you feel." And, you know, you can see other schools where guys lose it, get angry. And
of course.
Because NYU, they're not doing that. They're just, Sean kind of slid to the floor and just sat. All the other 3 guys, and one of them is a 3-time All-American. And Sean could whoop them all now. Mm-hmm. They all put their hands on him.
Oh.
They felt so bad for the guy. They just put their hands right on him, right? Wow. And then Sean sat there for a minute, and then he said, "You know what? I guess they probably canceled it for all the right reasons. Just go get our parents to go out for dinner."
Wow.
That's someone you would hire.
Meantime, he applies for a job at Price Waterhouse, number one accounting firm in the country. First interview, he's hired.
Yeah.
They take him.
Wow. Yes.
And he's at Price Waterhouse. He goes, "Coach, can I help you, coach?" And I said, "Sean, nothing I'd want more," right?
Yeah.
So he's coaching with me. And this year he said, "I have to resign." I said, "Why?" Because he got the quarterly evaluations. He got the highest evaluation and he got promotion or two during this window of time. And this last evaluation, he got an average evaluation. And he goes, "I need to know my priorities."
I'm like, wow.
Like, Sean.
Not above average. Average. No,
but I mean, you got to love this kid.
That's amazing.
Yeah, what a story that is.
Yeah.
So Division III athletics, you went from Manhattan to NYU?
They dropped the program in Manhattan. I started putting resumes in at jobs that were opening. Buffalo, Hofstra, Seton Hall, and NYU.
Okay.
NYU is the only D3 job. Now, meantime, I could say now that D3 is where I belong. We're probably where I should have been to start, but I'm taking a job. You give me a job, I'm taking it. So I went from wrestling D3 to coaching D1. So then now these other jobs open up. I apply for all of them, and I get an offer for an interview in all of them.
Wow.
All right. So nice. I got flown up to Buffalo, interviewed for the job. They gave it to somebody else. I went to Hofstra, interviewed for the job. They hired Tom Ryan. And Tom Ryan now is the head coach at Ohio State.
Okay.
Wow.
So I didn't get that job. I go to Seton Hall. Interviewed for the job, they offered me the position. And I said, "I'll take it." I got 10 scholarships. "What's my salary?" I believe they said something like $12,000. I said, "Why?" They said, "Did you not know that this was a part-time position?"
Wow.
Like, and so that raised a red flag. You're giving all these scholarships and you're bringing a guy on part-time. So now I didn't have anything else. So I said, okay, I'll take the job. I said, you sure you don't need somebody to sweep the basketball court? I'm not proud. I'll do anything. No, we don't have anything for you. So I take the job. I get home. The phone rings. I answer it. And she goes, Bruce Haverly? I go, yeah. She goes, this is Janice Quinn from NYU. And she goes, I was talking to Jack Powers. We're looking for a coach. Jack Powers said, you're the man for the job.
Wait, remind me, is this the man you weren't sure liked you or not?
No, that was the president.
Okay.
What's not to like?
And also, when we write the movie, I will make it the person who didn't like you who then gives a recommendation. Yeah. That's the better. But yes. Okay, great. I'm straight now.
So yeah. So Jack Powers, guy from the NIT, he contacted Janet. The position was open and Janet said she wants to meet me. So I went down. The athletic director was retiring. Janice was the associate AD. I went and met with her, and she goes, I'd like you to meet the assistant chancellor. Do you have time? Because I'm going to call him. And I said, sure. But I met him, and they offered me the job right away. I accepted the job. Now I have keys to two coaches' offices, one at Seton Hall and one at NYU. NYU was full-time. That was one of the first questions I asked.
Yeah.
And it was Division III. I was one of the first D3 full-time coaches.
Nice.
Wow. So in wrestling, because this is over 30 years ago.
Okay.
By the way, Janice and I are both there still.
Wow. That's awesome.
That is great. That
so you have the keys to both kingdoms.
Yep. I get in my car, drive back to Seton Hall, and now I got to face him, which was pretty uncomfortable. But you just step up and do it.
Wow. So how long have you been there now?
30 years. Either 30 or 31.
Okay.
I think I started in 95, 96.
Wow.
What would you consider the biggest change over that 30 years?
It's a relatively easy answer. I've learned how to go full circle in terms of what makes a student athlete be the best student athlete. You know, when I grew up, it was, are you foaming at the mouth? You know,
yeah. Right.
Just that's just a phrase. I really wasn't foaming at the mouth, but it's just, and that's how I wrestled. It was just get away from me. Nobody talked to me. I'm ready to go out and kill this guy. It was hard to see how anything could be better than that. But there's a lot of education out there and a lot of changes over the years. There's actually full-time people doing sports psychology. It's all about learning how to relax. It's all about getting rest, not overthinking it, not acting like you're settling world peace. It's a sport, and calming down and relaxing and be able to wrestle with that approach.
Right.
Especially in pressure matches. You need to be able to relax and you'll compete your best. It's only a sport. It's hard for me to even think that way because I wasn't that way ever.
Yeah, big difference.
But it's a big difference, yeah. So if you could learn how to relax, put the sport in perspective, you can go on out there and you could participate at your highest level.
There has to be a thought component to what you're doing. You have to think your way.
What is your favorite part about coaching?
I think working with young people. I think it keeps you young. I know I'm not young. The numbers don't lie. I've heard you say the numbers don't lie once before.
Yes.
So I'm 65, so I need to be smart. I don't think I'm going to do nothing. I think I'm going to do something, right? I'm not going to retire and go fishing. It's not going to be me. But I would like to leave the program in a good place. The thing I always thought I would be doing as a coach would be I would be on the mat all the time. And that's just not true. You become an administrator. You know, your assistants are on the mat all the time. You're preparing things and you're making things happen. Doesn't make me love it any less. And now I probably can't get on the mat. I got two total knee replacements.
Yeah.
You know, getting on the mat, not smart.
Yeah, pointing is powerful.
That's right. You do this and you do that. That's right.
Is it a fair assessment that you don't feel like you've worked a day in your life?
That's a very good assessment, except for the days I got in trouble.
Bruce get in trouble? Never.
But yeah, doing something I love, 100%. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of people in all different professions, and especially younger people. And what I try to impart on them is a work career is generally around 40 years.
Yeah.
And if you're going to do something for 40 years that you absolutely hate, it's going to take time off your life.
Yep.
Somehow, some way. Bruce is a classic example of doing something that he really loves. It's very admirable.
Well, if you look at all my coaching jobs, I've hit the 40 because I'm 31 at NYU and then Manhattan for 8 and LIU Post for 1. So I'm right there.
You're right there. Yeah. Let me just shift to the portal. Are you affected by the portal?
I love the portal.
What is the portal?
Yeah. People could transfer now without having to do nearly as much as they used to have to do. So if you're at a Division I school, you don't like it, you could put your name in a portal, and the portal shows everybody online that you're available, you want to transfer, right?
Wow.
And so we're a school like NYU will do well with the portal, right? Because students want to go there. Now we're getting a guy who might have got a scholarship who's in the end of his career, maybe had an All-American in front of him, he couldn't start. Who knows what the truth is, right? But they want to transfer. I reach out to them and they're going to be interested. So we got two guys off the portal this year, one from Cornell and one from UVA that are going to be winners for us.
So you don't get scholarships with D3 at all, across the board.
Yep.
So we had a question about a mom saying, my kid's playing D3 volleyball. We're looking at loans and part-time jobs. Do you have players who have part-time jobs? Do you feel like it's a stress? Are there academic scholarships? Do you see that side of it at all?
All the time.
Yeah.
So first of all, in terms of coaches, it's against NCAA rules for us to get involved in the financial aspect. But yes, we can advise.
Yeah.
We know how they could save money. We have all these different things. They have the NYU promise, right? The NYU promise now is if you have a low-income kid who's a good student and he can get accepted, if the family makes under $100,000, you go for free.
So, wow.
So that's hugely helpful. Things like dorms, you can become an RA. The NYU has so many dorms because the school's big. And some floors, there's two RAs. So getting an RA job is not hard. If you get an RA job, it pays for your housing and your meals, right?
Wow. That's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's ways of making things happen. The meal plan and the housing, the varying costs are huge. You know, so you can have a rich kid taking the top dorm where he actually lives by himself and the whole thing. And then you can have somebody who's on economy triples, you know, and the difference is many thousands. Right. The meal plan, I always advise parents, especially for incoming freshmen, don't worry about your kid eating three meals a day. Don't pay for it because you're throwing lots and lots of money away.
Really?
Your son will be in that cafeteria once, maybe twice a day. He will never be in there three times a day.
Breakfast, not happening.
No, not happening. So, you know, these guys are stopping at the store, picking up a tasty cake or something on the way to class. You save a ton of money.
Love the tasty cake reference, by the way.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm a big fan myself. I'm a little more hostess, but I like tasty cake.
I always ask guests if there's usually a couple of aha moments. It could be something very small, something very big. And I'm not talking about someone winning a national championship. I'm just talking about, let me give you an example.
That's good.
I was coaching baseball at the rec level. And there was this young man who wasn't selected for the All-Star team. And a lot of people, when they're not selected for something, they kind of go home and just wallow about it. But this kid just kept coming around to practices, and he'd be at all the games, and he would have his glove on and his baseball pants and a hat. And one day I was coaching and we had an injury. I needed a player. I look over and I see this kid, Roman Haberle. And Roman knew that I loved him. I coached Roman and I fought for Roman. And I put him in center field. Like anything in baseball, the ball finds you.
Yep.
The kid from the opposing team hits a rope to center. Roman on the dead run backhands it, catches it for the out.
Wow.
It was a big play in the game. Okay. And Bruce may or may not remember this.
I remember almost everything.
Yeah. How could you not?
Baseball.
Yeah. And when you flip a year later, we're playing a game and Roman is now an established part of the team. And he was the first player I coached at the rec level that hit a home run over the fence in left center.
Wow. Okay?
In the rain.
Yeah. So it was an aha moment for me, okay, because I was pulling for the kid. I had to convince others in positions of evaluation, I guess I would call it. It was a good parenting example. Bruce and his wife, Michelle, could have confronted me and say, hey, how come you didn't fight for this kid to be on the team? He deserves to be on the team. He loves the game, the whole bit. They took an opposite approach of saying, hey, Roman, what can you do to get better? To me, that was an aha moment.
Yeah.
So when you coach during a season, it doesn't have to be your best wrestler. It's just a moment that you see that nobody else really understands but you.
Yeah. Here's the thing. With wrestling, more than most sports, it's almost like the writing's on the wall. You know where your kids are at. You know where they are as athletes. Like, you know where they are when they get there. You don't see a whole lot of big jumps or big surprises. You just watch that slow development. It's a steady thing. And the guys who work hard are going to reap the benefits. But you, that's not an aha situation either, because they're working hard and you're anticipating this. So, you know, outside of the actual competition and competing, you see character things and things that might be aha moments on a personal level.
Right.
But not necessarily wrestling. You know, it's fun when you watch guys go out and they wrestle. They both think they're going to win. They got that competitive juices going and you see a great match. But you know they're both good. You know where they both are as wrestlers.
Right.
And you know you're going to see a great match. And so there's no surprises happening here. You don't see too many aha moments.
I think how I would characterize Coach Bruce Haberle is that he's had 40 years of aha moments. There's nothing that he loves more and is better at than what he's doing.
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment? That's
very fair.
Yeah.
What else would I do if I was a wrestling coach? Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
It's a pleasure hearing your life story and how you've been living in your purpose this long.
Yeah. By the way, if you don't mind me saying.
Please.
One of the things that I've taken to college wrestling was your dad's approach to talking to his team.
Go on.
Wow.
Yeah. This is a huge compliment.
I used to remember when your dad was not happy with something. I'll give an example. We're playing baseball in 95 degree heat, and it's an all-star team. And we're out there, and the kids are dragging. He knows it, and the kids are hot. And he has this thing where he's sitting on his baseball bucket.
Oh, I remember the bucket so well.
Sitting on his baseball bucket.
Visor on.
In the middle of a game, timeout, and he just does one clap. And they would run in, and they would run in, and they would get on a knee. And if he was disappointed, he would talk lower. And that raised their attention to a high level.
They had to lean in.
Boys, you know, it's 95, but it's 95 for me too. And I'm here with you guys. It's 95 degrees for all your parents that are sitting in the stands. And we're here. So we could play lazy or we could play our best, but we're going to be here anyway. He was like, do we understand? Are you guys ready to play? You know, and he was like, okay, get back out to your position. Boom, they ran out.
One clap.
But that approach of don't lose it, you know, have that conversation.
Yeah, focus in.
I remember that stuff when I kept that with me. Wow. So I'm going to thank you for that one.
The thank you was well received. I appreciate it.
Yeah, how does that make you feel?
I tell you, I always felt that how you ran out to your position, how you returned from your position in baseball was a sign of unity. So in practice, I tried to be very active with the sport, but when the inning was over, if they walked in, I said, no, we're going to do that over. So
Get back out to your position.
I remember this personally.
Yeah. So every softball or baseball team I coached, it was an expectation.
Yep.
Okay. Because someone's always watching. And Bruce brings up, is very meaningful what he just said. Someone's always watching.
There's a few things like that. Well, being on time, I remember that. If practice starts at 11 and you show up at 11, you're late.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that stuff. It was fantastic.
Yeah. By the way, I'm now in a career where there's a lot of similarities to sports and it's a lot of teamwork. You know, rehearsal could be like a practice and the way you show up is noticed and the way you get up from your seat to go rehearse your scene is noticed. And I mean, I would rather die than not run out to shortstop. That's how I grew up. Yeah. But it's paid off in a big way.
Yeah. You need to respect the game. The first time we were trying to fix the fields on a rain delay, but I was out there with your dad. And it was only him and I on the field at the time. And I didn't know him yet. And so Dan Smith, great guy. Once you know him, before you know him, there's a certain level of quietness.
Yes.
And I worked out on that field, trying to get that field together with him. And then taking his instruction, we pretty much didn't talk for the whole time. It doesn't matter.
He's
a great coach. It's going to benefit my son. I'm going to do this. And then once you get to know him, you know.
You intimidated the head coach of NYU.
Oh, my goodness.
He did.
That's crazy.
And then once we got to know him, he challenged me to go dive in a closing pool. As they were closing the Monfell pool, getting ready to pull the thing over at the end of the season, he's like, Bruce, you won't go dive in that pool, will you? And that's all he had to say. And he had all his buddies there. I said, okay. Took my shirt off, ran, dove into the pool. They were trying to stop me on the way through.
Oh, this is amazing. Wow.
Yeah. There's a few stories out there.
Well, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We're proud to know you, Bruce, of course. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much. I will. Certainly for the next few years.
Yeah.
That's it for the Bruce Haberle.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
All right. We had Bruce Haberle in the studio today.
Yes, sir. Guy can spin a tale.
Yeah. If we had to name his life story into a movie, what would you title it?
I think it's like a little bit of a Rudy story.
Maybe it's just called Bruce.
What I like about his story is it didn't start. Things came as easy as pie. So he had to work at his craft.
Well, here's to work ethic. You talk about it all the time and financial planning. It was great to hear about his work ethic.
I'm a big believer in it. And he's a big example of it.
Yeah. I mean, you're working with people's hard-earned money. You want to take care of it.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, that was Bruce Haberle. We'll see you next month. Love you.
Love you.
This podcast
is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.